you say I'm supposed to talk on my own research?
No.
Oh, okay. I thank so much, Bridget, because could somebody take the caps off? Right, thanks. So that's my name and my email address. And as Bridget pointed out, I have been supported by the NCRR, which is the same agencies that support the resource here at Scripps. And in our facilities, we have one of these Fujiyoshi types of instruments which allow us to operate at liquid helium temperature with pre-emission gun and a small 2K by 2K CCD camera.
Oh, thanks.
The second button, okay. And so the missions of our research has been a kind of complementary to what goes on here at Scripps. We have been focused in developing both the experimental and computational infrastructures for pushing the structural determinations on large macromolecular machines close to the resolution of the microscope. And also, we don't want to use crystal if we can avoid it by electron quantum microscopy. So that is our missions. And so when Bridget and Ron told me about these workshops and it was a summer, and they say, well, I talk about future cryo-EM. And in Houston, in summer, it was very warm. I could do anything. So I said, yes. But then in the meantime, I was asked to give a title. I said, well, how about I talk about my research, which is something I think I can do. But then I came here, I saw the program called Future Cryo-EM that made me extremely nervous. So the reason I'm nervous is for twofold. The future means I don't need any slide because it's nothing. There's no document, this future. So secondly, I'd be worried because why they asked me to give this title to talk about, that means suggest that maybe I'm incapable of doing anything at the present time. So maybe a bit nervous. And thirdly, I noticed last few nights, you know, there's a question there about evaluation because I'm very sensitive in terms of score. So please be kind to me. But given that, I thought that in talking about future, we need to always look back. So history is actually important. So I divided my discussion this morning about what has EM accomplished. I think last few days you have heard about a lot of examples. I don't think I want to go into details about that. Then I think many of you actually are kind of curious, why are you here? You know, what are the future? Because every student and postdoc come to my lab is ask me, what are the futures? Future means jobs and money, I guess. For some people. The others say they don't want any money. They just want to get the Nobel Prize, so for fans. So there's one of the three things. So since I'm sure I won't get the Nobel Prize, but I want to have a job and the money. So I think some of you may think it that way, so I would focus on that. That Derek DeRose and I will talk about the Nobel Prize, which they have done. And so then I think it's also important about the peer pressures, about what are the trendy things. You don't want to do things just down in the basement, which many of us are in the basements, but hopefully those will be a kind of trendy activities. And then, of course, if we want the technology to be usable by the biologists, and I want to just have some discussions to kind of pave the way for tomorrow's all-day symposiums. And finally, I want to touch something which I really enjoy in talking about, what are the cryo EM technology in the future that would be that we are thinking of. So first of all, I want to just spend one slide to talk about what has been done, just in case you slept through the last few days. So for microscopy, for two-dimensional crystal, as Vince and Mark has talked about, that 2D crystal come to the stage that one can solve a 3D structure to close to 3-angstrom resolution, and polypeptide backbone can be traced. So this is well exemplified by membrane protein and the tubulin 2D crystals. So I think the importance of this, not only the biology, but come to the field or the biology, to the community, that cryo-EM technique is really a fundamentally high resolution technique. So I think that gives us hope that for the rest, the kind of specimen, that is something that we can look forward to get to these kind of resolutions. And Nigel, the other night, talked about the helical arrays at 4-angstroms, and Sam, as some of you have heard about, she saw the movie last night that David shows in the Fajella case, that one can get down to 4-angstroms, the protein fold can be recognized. By protein fold, I mean the connectivities of the secondary structure of the protein can be traced. And then last few days, some of you might have heard Tim Vickers and Yaoping Fang and Steve Lukey talk about the single particles, and that technology has come a long way. About decades ago, it was only 40 angstroms, now get down to 9 to 5.5 angstroms. At that resolution, the alpha helices and beta sheets can be easily recognized. And lastly, but not the least, is about the subcellular assembly. You heard about the talk from Boulder that one can actually look at the whole cells and recognize subcellular components, and that kind of 50 to 20 angstroms. I think these are really biologically important. I just getting used to this morning, Alex Stephen actually did a science paper on the herpes virus yesterday, which again using the tomography approach. And so I think this is the accomplishment that the field has gone. So I think the question is, how can we further along these accomplishments going beyond that? And so, and I kind of like to use a kind of rationale. So what are the funding opportunities? Because we can be intellectually interested, but there's no money, so that's not doable. So then, in doing that, I kind of like to draw your attention about the NIH strategic planning and the recently called NIH roadmap to try to enhance the science, to advance the biomedical research as well as enhance the American health. So the director of NIH paved up about 5 different categories, new pathway to discovery, and one actually numbers of them are really relevant to the bio-EM community, particularly the area on structural biology and also on the biological pathway networks, undoubtedly the bioinformatics and computational biologies. So I just kind of like to zoom in about the structural biology. About 3 years ago, the NIH has started called Protein Structure Initiative, which was before this roadmap that initiated a few months ago in NIH. So at that time, the NIH has set up 9 centers. They are almost exclusively for X-ray crystallography. The idea is after the genome sequencing, the next great challenge in biology is to discover all the possible folds of the proteins. And an estimate probably about close to 10,000 folds. So they set up 9 centers with tens of millions of dollars. And so each of the centers target to around 120 structures per year. That means if you work 200 days a year, and then that means one structure a day. That's what they target, okay? So this is one example in the New York Genomic Center. So they saw so far 60 structures, so it's still half of what they targeted so far. So far, each of these centers hasn't reached the target yet. So the NIH idea is, well, they ask the question, why they're so slow? The answer is they probably don't have enough money. So the result of that, they actually give them more money, so hopefully they could do it faster and approach the target. Now, so that is what the money go to the X-ray crystallographer. And then the question is anything left for us? So I think in the next initiative, which just started about less than 2 weeks ago, and they start on this initiative part 2, which is focused on the membrane proteins. As you point out last few days, membrane proteins definitely represent the family of protein, which has not been well characterized. I think EM definitely plays a very important role, like, for example, the Nobel Prize given this year. One of the awardees is actually the structure analysis equipoise, and I think the world party is actually done here at Scripps. So I think those information is extremely valuable in terms of understanding the membrane proteins. And as you heard the numbers of talks last few days, from Nigel, from Vince, from Mark, and I think membrane protein represent an important class. Now, so the question is, as a cryo-EM microscopy, what role can we play? Personally, I think it can be a very important role. And so this is the RFA that real things already announced. That opportunity does exist. So now, as a cryo-EM persons, we can, if you want to study membrane protein, we definitely have several approaches the course show you. We can, of course, we need to purify the protein first, and I think we have, this is a challenging problem at the moment. Assume that can be done, and what, besides X-ray crystallography and NMR, I think the EM approach can do 2D crystal, helical array, and single particles. So I kind of like to make a couple comments. What are the roadblocks that we we have to overcome in order to get these kinds of opportunity, because what they are really interested is atomic resolution. So I think this is the journey. I think we, if we want to get that pot of money, I think that's the way we have to go. And so in terms of 2D crystals, I'd like to show an example from Ren and Mitra's work on aquapolline. If you have a good crystal, you can actually get a diffraction pattern go beyond 2.8 angstrom resolution. So I think that's a lot of work, but it's actually doable. I think there are increasing numbers of these examples in the last few years, and in Dean's experience and Mark and so on. I think these are definitely a promising area. But I think the tough work is you need to do biochemistry. I think we come to the point that that is an integral part of bio-EM. You need to involve in purifying the protein. You actually need to involve in making the crystals. And I think this is a very labor-intensive work. And I think with the initiator and I just started this month, I think that provides an opportunity for people doing these kinds of work. In other words, there are two types of research. One is hypothesis-driven. The other is technology. I think one of the opportunities we can do technology not hypothesis-driven. In other words, we don't need to ask the question, what are the functions that we are interested in? Just get the structure. Once get the structure, we can derive the function. So I think it's a important distinction. I think, interesting enough, there are about three or four study sections being set up to entertain that kind of proposal. It's not a matter of driven by the biology alone. So now, in order to get this kind of approach, and similar to the helical arrays, I think these are the challenges in the future. We have to, of course, make the superdome crystal or helical arrays, and if we get the crystal just like the aquapolines, and there's opportunity of the bacterial toxin, we can solve structures at 3 angstroms, and I think this is not the limits of the microscope. The microscope can go well beyond 3 angstroms. I mean, the microscope you and I buy has guaranteed to be 2 or 2.2 or what's the guarantee in the FEI instrument? 1.4, right? So we are still at least improve at least a factor of 2. So that gives you everybody have jobs, you know, because that's a lot of work to get to there. So that to me is an opportunity. I see no reason, once you get a yes on diffraction pattern to go to below 3 angstrom, there's no reason we can't get the structures down to that level. The reason we haven't done it is because nobody wants to do it. Okay, but I think since there are funding opportunities, I see no reason for those who can engage in that kind of approach. Now, and I think this other approach, the other thing I'm thinking of, if you can't get this big and large coherent crystal, the other is you work on so-called comic crystal as Vince pointed out. And I'm in the proponent that perhaps we want to take into account of not using the Fourier averaging, but also using the single particle approach. And I think this, I predict this will be extremely promising procedures. And again, that requires some of you to work out all the computational procedures. I see no reason why conceptually that cannot be done. And of course, so far, all the 2D crystal, the helical arrays at high resolution, most of them are pioneered at MRC. By definition, you have to be as intelligent as Nigel and so on and so forth to work on those projects. And so I think we really need some more user-friendly than average biology like me, and maybe some of you can actually use it also. I think there is a demand on more user-friendly software for 2D crystal and helical array as this technology becomes to be more popular. And so now, the other approach other than 2D helical arrays is to do single particles. So this is, for example, an image of these single type particles of membrane proteins. So now, as you learned from the couple of days ago doing these kinds of problems, and the challenges in dealing with these kinds of problems, in particular membrane protein, is the structural homogeneous. Even though they may look really look like a interparticle, but it's potentially those molecules may be structurally heterogeneous, or they may have certain flexibilities. So as a result of that, we probably will, in order to meet that challenge, even though, again, FEI and Joe say you can take images to, you know, 3 angstroms in ice. You know, that is definitely doable. If you look at the transfer function, the signal-to-noise ratio go beyond definitely 5 angstroms, even in single particle. But exactly how you retrieve those data, I think this definitely, I believe that there are more development on algorithms to sort out the heterogeneous structures. Now, as a result of this heterogeneity, we probably need a lot of data. We need a lot of data, not only because the statistic, because if you look at what KG number shows is only what, 40,000 particles to get 4 angstroms. So if you look at the geometrical construct, you don't really need a lot of data. Just like if you run a very good lab, you don't need to have a giant map to do good science. The same principle. You just need a few selected good guys in the lab, or you need a good few selected particle, you would get the high resolution information. So for those of you who don't want to do experiments, I think this is an opportunity for you. Just go to develop more powerful algorithm. I think that would require creativities and insights. And I think, so this is what I think the opportunity in the case of membrane proteins. Now, so in case you're not interested in membrane protein, even though NIH, you know, have money for you to grab, so you say, I want to work on trendy one, a sexy and handsome one. So now, how do you look for the trend? Most of you look at journals. So you don't look at the journal I publish, because I publish in not trendy journal, but you probably look at Nature. Okay, Cell, you know, this kind of magazine. I don't call it journal, I call them magazine. So this magazine suggests that the trendy thing is look at complex. And so this is a news feature about a couple of years ago, say this is now time for looking at complexes, and then the microscopy technique is a timely method. So I think this is a trend. In fact, I picked this up in the bulletin outside the lab at the corner there. So I didn't read magazine, I read only journal. But anyway, I pick it up here. So this is a trendy thing. Now the good news about this biological complex is because of this, our center organized a workshop last spring in NIH, talk about the structural proteomics of biological complexes. So as you can notice, there's all the buzzwords, structure, proteomics, and complexes, and biomedical. Okay, so you have all the buzzwords in the titles. So for those of you who want to know a bit about this, because this is only about 20 somewhat prominent scientists, excluding myself, that has that in that meeting, so we have all the PowerPoint from the participants, so you're welcome to just browse through the PowerPoint through the web. And so it turned out after the workshops, and there's a little write-up by Andre Salit about the this whole area that you can actually look at structure, the journal structures, about 3 or 4 months ago. So I think that's complex is definitely a important area. I just had a meeting on Saturday with someone at UCSD. It turned out there's another meeting at NIH last week, that about what are the target of the structural genomics. Because structural genomic initially is only sort of a little protein, 40 to 50 to 60 kilodaltons. Now in the last meeting last week, the whole community could solve that they want to look at complex. They were dreaming they want to look at complexes. So again, I think that is an opportunity for us as a EM community to join forces with the Crystal. Of course, the Crystal want to do everything themselves, but at the end, I'm sure they will turn to one of you to get help. So I think that definitely, that is an opportunity right there. And so now the question, let's go into more serious matter. Why study science? I don't want the entire sales talk. I want to talk something intellectual like David and Nigel and Tim. So now why large complex? So large complex, typically, because we know proteins do not work alone. They always have partners. Okay? And the proteins virtually are important for every biological process. And those complex are absolutely relevant for all the diseases that you and I may possibly suffer. And so now after the genome sequence, they, you know, all these computational biologists try to classify proteins and gene products and so on. So the current estimate is approximately about 200 and 300 biological processes make up life. Okay? So that means how many of you here? 50. So that means each of you can work on 6 processes down the road. So that will probably take your next 20 years. So if you think about jobs, opportunities, be about 200 or 300 processes. Not you, but your graduate students can actually work on that. So you don't need to compete with your graduates and postdocs. So they have many problems to work on down the road. But the key is actually to isolate these complexes. And so now, the biology community is interested in this complex because there are numbers of techniques actually come in place all at one time. For example, now they're able, the biochemists begin to isolate these complex, and the mass specs are in place to characterize the complex. The genetics are so powerful to connect all the network of who talks to what and what are the gossiping from one protein to the other. So all of these are in the picture. But what they need to do is actually see them, how they talk to each other, how they can communicate. So I think all of these techniques come into place, and definitely cryo-EM in the central technology for these kinds of activity. And that is quoted by this prominent cell biologist, David Grubin at UC Berkeley. So now, what are the challenges if we really want to get into this business complex? Of course, we need the purification. Some of you like to do cooking and wet chemistry. That's definitely an opportunity to do that. And because remember, each of these biological processes, the complex involves not only one or two. We're talking about 30, 100, and 200 proteins in one complex. Some of them are not very stable. Some of them are transient. And many of them actually are very flexible because they work and they just don't sit there just like some of the professors. I mean, they actually work. So they become very flexible. They were very dynamic in terms of actions. And then I think one of the important things which I'd like to do on the next few minutes about the structure of mining. In other words, assuming we can do all this, how do we look at the data? Okay, how do we look at the structures? Because as you heard from this week, many of these structures now begin to go down below 10 angstroms. Given that the structures of a large complex like viruses, ribosomes, and all the other spliceosomes and whatever some, and those are really large complex, and given the structural genomic, give you the individual component what the folds are. So that turned out the structural mining, I think, is extremely challenging, just looking how to discover knowledge from our structure. So that in the next few minutes, what I want to do on is how we discover information from the 3D structures. And so the first example I'd like to give is this so-called Rhizol virus. Now, I don't want to go into the biology of any example. I just wanted to mention about the pertinent technology, how we can extract information. And this is the work in collaboration with Hong Zhao when he first started this project in the lab. Now he's a professor at the Houston Medical School. And then with all the people list here who assisted in the mining of the structures. So we used a really ancient microscope. It's actually, the data was collected, 400 kilowatt microscope with an LAB6 gun. It's basically about 25-year technology, but it still can able to get, beyond 7 angstrom structures. And this is very large particle. It has 26 million dalton protein mass, so it's a kind. Virus, it turns out a lot of people don't like virus, it's just all this medical thing. But it turns out virus is a very good machine to think about because it talks about protein-protein interaction, protein-nuclein actions, and they have really dynamic structures as well. So I think that is why I think virus, as the molecular biology started on the bacteriophage 30 or 40 years ago, is a really good paradigm for the molecular biology. So that's why I like to use the example. So we don't want motor and that kind of stuff. Too complicated. So here is the structures. This virus turned out to have two shells. And so this is the outer shell, make up of one protein. And then this is a inner shell, make up another protein. So each of the protein, one is a 46 kilodalton, another is 114 kilodaltons. And now, what I want to do is a structure like this. When it's done, it has a pixel, something like close to 500 by 500 by 500 pixels. It's not a ribbon diagram. It's extremely difficult to navigate into the computer. And now it looks very nice because we colored it with a crayon in different color. It's easy to see. But before you color it, it's all density everywhere. There's noise, there's signal. So that is actually not a trivial problem. And so what we do, I just want to get you an example how we can mask this information. Now, assuming this phi trimer, the phi trimer 4 1/4 basically is one asymmetric unit. In this virus, there are 60 copies. So the 60 copies of this, once you understand one copy, you basically understand the rest. And so now, in here, what I want to emphasize, after you get the structures, it's actually the beginning. It turned out with all these high throughput, with all these smart people like Tim and others, Tony Carver and Hong Zhao, I mean, they developed this software, it's tremendous. You can do it basically a few days. But after the structure, actually what that means takes about weeks and months sometimes. And those I think it's, at the moment, it's not yet automated, because that is, well, I mean, if everything is automated, what do we do? Become a manager, just like some of us. That's no good. So you, that's, right now, it's a discovery process, okay, because that is where the excitement is. And so now, these are kind of five trimers. So what we did was to, because to first evaluate how each of these trimers, how good the threefolds. So we have quantitative analysis to figure out how good the threefolds are. And then once we did each trimer is actually have a threefold symmetry, then we computational averaging. So this is we call non-icosahedral averaging. So which enhances the signal-to-noise ratio, we get one trimer. And based on that one trimer, then we do is to look, because I told you I have 6.8 angstrom based on that 40 cell correlation, the 0.5 threshold. Then at that resolution, I would expect to see alpha helices, which I call, David called rod, I call sausage, because I'm hungry. I don't want to beat on people with a rod, I say sausage. So we have a program called Helix Hunter, which is basically a hunting for helices. Okay, it's a correlation analysis, similar to the concept that Vince nicely demonstrated using the correlation method. You start with a putative helix, and you go to that to look at your density, which one look like the putative helix. So we discover in this case, in this trimer, all the helices appear in the bottom of each of the monomers. So the red color represents one monomer of the trimers, and now I zoom in one of the monomers, and the green one are the cylinders, which we annotate as helices. Okay, and then the rest are the real density that determined from the reconstruction. So I think it's very important to show the density because that testifies how good the quality of the map is. Because in Christopher, they show you the ribbon diagram, you never see any data. I think at this point of the climate, I still like to see the density, but give me a comfort level how good, how reliable the map is. So in here, you can see all these sources density, which we mined it as a kinetic. You can see actually some connectivity around there as well. So I think this tells us that in the monomer, in the bottom part is where the helices lie. And the top part, it looks like a kind of flat surface, like pancake, you know, three pieces of pancake. So by looking at the protein data bank structure at these kind of seven angstroms, you will recognize a structural signature that beta sheets actually look like these kinds of things. Particularly when you change the threshold of the density, you will be able to recognize that is the case. So now, after you get this, you know, you find the helices, you find the sheets, and the question is, can we, based on this, to go beyond that, to build a, I call, superatomic level? So, as I pointed out, we can do the helix hunting by computational analysis instead of just looking at it. But at the same time, we look at other bioinformatics about the molecular components, the machines. And, of course, one of the obvious things is look at the sequence. And from the sequence, you can go to the web, you can do secondary structure predictions, you can do the full recognition, again, it's a sequence based, or you can just predict the structure if it's a small enough protein, or you can components or domains. And of course, occasionally, some of these, some of the components of domain has been crystallized and solved. And in this Rigel virus, when we did it, there was no crystallography being done yet. Neither the virus nor the proteins. In fact, there was one crystallization note in 1990 that report this Rigel virus was crystallized. I went to talk to a crystallographer in Japan. They asked me, get lost. I said, you're not from Team Baker's lab. I said, no, so get lost. So I get lost. So we went ahead to do the work. And so now, with all these kind of informations, then I believe by these integrations of information that we can build the pseudo-atomic map models. So I just want to just share with you how we approach this. First, we look at the sequence. From sequence prediction, we find out that both end of these proteins are helices. So now, then from here, we can start measuring the length in our map. Also, we can measure the length from the predictions and also the connectivity and the distances. As a result of that, we can then begin to put assignments which cylinders or sausage density may consider to be which portions of the sequence of the proteins. Now, so there we take care, we build the initial model. Now, in our Helix Hunter program, we actually we're very cautious, as Vince pointed out, when you do correlations, you always get an answer. There's some strong correlation, some weak correlation. So we actually scoring system that those helices, we are in a kind of marginal case, and we put it in a kind of orange color. So means, yeah, we think it is, but we may be wrong. Okay, but the green one, we're pretty sure these are correct. And so, and now, but what happened to the top part? As I said, the structural signature looked like a beta sheet. And so we go on these so-called fedding experiments, again, based on the sequence. Then you can plug it into the server, and then you can predict that sequence regions, what likely fold is. In other words, then based on a number of combinations, these techniques pioneered by Eisenberg at UCLA, and right now there is lots of other servers actually provide that kind of information. In particular, lots of graduate students don't want to do experiments like to do these kinds of things. So for those who are difficult and recruit graduate students, just then, well, you can do computing, go to the web, they love that. So now from there, we pull out this fold in the protein data bank, and then we use another program called Fold Hunter, which again is six-dimensional search. We can then find which what density of RMAP actually can match this. So in this case, we actually match our kinds of match. Now keep in mind that in terms of the sequence, there's no other protein that has more than 20% similarity with this protein. In other words, you look at the sequence world, there's nothing look like this protein. Now, if nothing look like this one, doesn't mean it doesn't, in sequence, it doesn't mean it doesn't look like in three dimensions. And in fact, there are more cases now. There's very low level of sequence homology similarity, but there's a very high structural similarity. So based on this, we build a model. We publish it in 2001 in Nature Structural Biology. So we, based on this, we make the connectivity by looking at the map between these cylinders. So we build this. And about last month, the Christopher eventually, after 12 years, I think they eventually get the map, probably with Jack Johnson's help here. And so this is the one that published 2 months ago in Structures. So as you can see, basically all the green cylinder connectivity agree with the X-ray map that they saw from the crystallography of the entire virus. The one that we assigned it wrongly are the fire and egg, which we were a kind of doubt was cautious that may not be right. But the interesting thing, they are there. Okay, but we just move the connectivity incorrectly. So, of course, the beta sheet predicts numbers of strand, they're more or less correct. But I think for helices, it's easy to predict to be right, but for the beta sheets, for the computational people, there's still a big challenge. Okay, so I think that represents a kind of activity once we get the structures. There's a lot of structure mining and activity that goes on. I think there are other structural prediction business, I think, that is definitely a logical to incorporate those kinds of approach to this kind of sub-nanometer resolution map. So that gives you an first example how the activity can be engaged after you get the structure for large complex. Now the other example I like to talk about is an ecosomal bundle. Now this is the work that has been spearheaded by Mike Smith, who was a crystallographer and incorporated a cell biology promise at Whitehead in MIT. And this data was collected by Michelle Sherman and helped also the initial processing. Now, this represents to me this exciting cell biological problem. And because it happens in a sperm where the sex begins, and when the sperm see the egg, this coil, which is we call actin bundle, ecosomal bundle, actually extended from a coil form to extended form when you see the eggs, and penetrate through the Jericho. And this is a system that David DeRose pioneered some years ago, so he had a lot of model how this thing works. In those days, he was actually looking at only one filament along this bundle, which I'll get into that in a minute. So in this one, they actually make out three proteins. One is called Skuin, it's 102 kilodalton, and actins, you know, and then gamma-modulin, it's got kind of one-to-one ratios. And so if we isolate this ecosomal bundle, and that's how it looks in the microscope. It turned out this is a lucky specimen. It's highly crystalline, okay? And And the unit cell is 147 by 147 by 752. So it's a pretty large unit cell. So what you mark out here is four unit cell row by row. Now in terms of schematically, this is how the bundle looks like. There has about 100 filaments. Each filament is a really long one, just like garden hose, with about 50 micron long bundles, and with about 150 angstrom wide filaments. So there are about hundreds of them. So the biological question is how they pair, how they coil from a coil form to an extended form. So that's the biology. And the other question is how does the actin look like in this kind of environment? Because like Ron Milligan showed you, all actins look like. So, but those are isolated actin or are binding actin with some one or two proteins. But here is I consider this a kind of intracellular organelle. Within that organelle, how would the protein look like? Okay, so that is the biological questions. And so, now because this is a crystal, so I kind of like to show you how this look like in both the real space and foreign space. So you can mask out two unit cell, and then this whole diameter is about 1,000 angstrom, you get a computer diffraction pattern looks something like this. Now, if you go along this bundle, you see this feature actually change as well as the computer diffraction pattern. It turns out this bundle is not a strict crystal. It's a kind of quasi-crystal, and this bundle actually twists. So every unit cell, it's look change according to the diffraction pattern change. So you can see that actually some of these spots, okay, are changing because you equivalent to different orientation or actually different black spacings or different orientation in your single particle language. So this actually varies. So our challenge is to how to process data of this kind. Okay, it's not two three-dimensional crystal, but it is a quasi three-dimensional crystal. So now, the reason I want to show this example are actually three folks. One, there are plenty of cellular organelle which has not been tackled. Okay, so that means that's an opportunity for many of you, number one. Number two, many of these problems is not an off-the-shelf solution. Okay, you learn about 2D crystal, you learn about single particle, you learn about helices. This is none of above. So as a result, that means there's an opportunity for those particles who have crystallographic background. How do you tackle problem of this kind? Okay, so, and lastly, is after you get a structure, how you interpret it, also a big challenge. So here, I want to show you the structures. Now, I don't want to go through the procedure how we get the structure. It's actually come up in a paper by Mike Smith in a Bridget special issue that tell you all the procedures, how to tackle those problems, because it's no longer a lattice rot in forest space. So, now, here is the structures. Since I told you the unit cell 140 by 140 by 760, so we just chunk out one unit cell, and that's a mess. So again, we need to get a computer crayon to color it. So we single out one unit cell in the middle, which is, it's got radial color in red and yellow. And so now, since this resolution, we have go down to 9.5 angstrom. Our first challenge is, now, keep in mind, in the whole analysis, we treat it completely crystallographically. We do not assume any helical symmetry. We don't assume, we only assume a crystallographic symmetry. So now we know by biochemistry you have an actin. So one of the first validation, does our map look like actin? Right? That's fair. Okay. But it turns out the actin is in the very middle on the filament, so we have to take it out to see it. So first thing we know, also, this is the filament. It's formed a helical, somewhat helical array, a filament. But the question is this a kind of two helical array as what the helical rule of the actin is? The answer is not. But before we know what that is, we do a helical averaging, because a unit cell contains 28 subunits of actin and suet. So we do a first approximations to do an averaging, assuming everything is perfect. And from there, from the first average, then we zoom in and file one of the subunits, which is the actins, and based on that subunit, then we do a correlation search, both the asymmetrical and axial. So there's a kind of two-dimensional correlations to find out which of these subunits are along the filament, because I don't want, at the end, assume each of these subunits follow the strict helical rule, okay, as you learn in the cell biology textbooks. And so from there, then we find all the correlation peaks, and from there we can go into the locations the peaks are to find out the structures of the actin and screw-in subunit. So I zoom in one of the actin subunit. Okay, so this is our first average after we get the structures. And so in fact, the actin has four domains and they are pentahelices. So again, at 9.5 angstrom, I was hoping to see some helices. So I change the threshold and look for sausage looking density. And in fact, these actually, there are some, and we use the helix hunter. We were able to pick up three helices very obviously in this map. And in fact, these match out the helix position in the subdomain 1 of the actin molecules. So based on this, we validate in our mind that our map is more or less correct. So now, but what happened to the rest of the helices, right? And it turned out in this map, the resolution is not entirely isotropic. So number one. Number two is this actin subunit may not follow this helical complete the two helical parameters. So our next task was to find out more accurately where each of these subunits are. So then we go into the protein data bank to pick up the actin subunit as using a template, and then go to look for the position of this actin in each of these 28 subunits in the unit cell. So that go into a six-dimensional shape, again using Min's lectures, using this correlation method, to find out the exact orientation of this actin subunit within the filament. So in here, we discover the different locations. Then after that, we do an average. So in this one, we actually pick up more density, look like a sausage density, which corresponds to the helices. And so here is the crystal structure coordinates, map it out in our highly average subunit, and so those cylinders are the density that correspond. We're able to pick up where the secondary structures of these actin subunits. So that gives us a comfort level. In fact, if we put Holmes model buried to 9.5 angstroms, it maps out our Y diagram is the EM, and the red contour is the crystal structure. As you can see, this actually match tremendously well. So after that, then we want to figure out exactly what kind of pattern these actins would follow. So we put up Holmes model, and we then superimpose in our EM density in color. So actin, you can think about two strands, and now we present two color. And you can see that in one strand, the actins look like tilted upward. And then in another strand in the blue, the actins looks like kind of rotated. So when we go through these 28 subunits, and in fact these are 1 to 14 subunits in the asymmetric unit, they look like one strand, the actin unit seem to be tilted outward, and then other actin subunits can rotate. So that suggests to us that kind of deviation from the two helix filament is not a random process. Now the exciting thing is in our entire structure determined, we don't assume anything. We only assume the crystallographic symmetry, and we were able to map out the pattern. So these are the kind of rotations, these two axes, where each of the subunits in the two strands are adapted itself. So I think the take-home message about this is we can solve this. We need to do these kinds of analysis by mining the structures and trying to find meaning of some of these molecular components. We know the structure, how it arranged in a kind of in vivo conditions that form a bundle which involve promacidora coils, the kind of biological spring. So, I mean, this example point out that as time goes on, we still need cryo-EM microscopy who understand both the structures and also image analysis. So that is the value of this course that you have experience in learning the fundamental, because many of the exciting projects down the road is probably not off-the-shelf item. Many of them are, but many of them probably are not. And so now, I want to go into the pace, some preview on what you'll be here tomorrow a lot. There, because of sociogenomics and I think activity, so people, the biology kind of like to have everything easy to use and high throughput. So again, we look at the magazine, and it says that 1 milligram of the cryo-electron microscopy can be automated. So this is very exciting, and so we are really grateful to this idea both Ron and Bridget that put forward and build this large enterprise here. I think it's good not only for many of us, but that's good for the broad biological community as well. So using that concept, we follow. So we develop a little high throughput activity because in our center, we saw half a dozen virus structures at 9 and 6 enzyme resolutions. We begin to ask the question, well, another graduation come in, I need to start from scratch again, I'm tired, getting old, you know. So I think Ruby and I is actually something automated. I don't need to teach the guy all over again. Because, you know, if a guy come in the lab who know nothing, it take a long time to learn that. So I think we'll be about time that we can actually have some of this procedure. We know very well what to do. And I think automation is useful when you know exactly what you're doing. And it's not useful when you're exporting something which you are trying to find out what that is. So this project is being had by Chris Booth, who is a graduate student, and held by Wayne and Matt and Mike and Steve. And so the idea is we get a, because most of the instruments we had in the past was old instruments, so we get a new instrument, a 200 kilovolt microscope with a few machine gun, and then we get a 4K by 4K camera. And so now it turned out that in the microscope, then most of the company just talk to itself and doesn't like to talk to other company. So in the case of the Joe microscope, they have this called FastM software, and they control the microscope because they build the microscope, and Catan build the camera because they think, well, if you want to take picture, Catan say they want to control the shutter. So the problem is who controls the shutter, the Joe or the Catan? And that become a political issue. Because as a microscopy like myself, it's absolutely apolitical. So we decide we do our own. So we want to control our shutter, the shutter of the instrument. And so we can take the picture we wanted. So we build this project we call JAMS, called JUL Automated Microscopy Ecosystems. And so so it's actually pretty easy to get the data. So this is a kind of CCD camera capture images and this bar spectrum, signal to noise ratio, and eganstroms still have about 5%. So it's a pretty good camera. And of course, when we got the camera, we were very skeptical because we saw years ago these CCD cameras are not good for anything except for years on defections. I think time has gone on. I think we have to be, you know, the problem is, many of us, the scientists, are fundamentally conservative. We form an impression. They watch you know, the big salesman, right? But no, we do science. I mean, so I think we need to think case by case, okay? So don't form a stereotype now. If you need to go to the Ivy League school like Yale, the first thing to teach you is politically correct. So don't form a perception. Judge on the science. That's just on the science. So, but anyway, the CCD camera, for a long time, I was skeptical, but I saw that actually about a couple of years ago that this coming. And so we tried it out. And so in fact the data get, you know, the signal to noise go down to eganstrom at the 60,000 magnification. So once we can easily get the data, in a few days we get all the data. But the problem is the software issue. So here these are jigsaw puzzle, each of the steps you learn from team and others. So we don't invent any software. So again, you know, some of the software, I think, is very difficult to reinvent. It's not impossible. Many of the software developers like to reinvent everything. Okay, as a biologist like me, I don't invent anything. I just want to use it. So I think there's a current trend for biology, simple-minded person. We, instead of reinvent everything, why don't we organize it, put it together, and wrap it around with a scripting language? So in other words, we can reuse some of the old software. And offense, if you want to write the new software, you can do it. So I think, again, it will be a continued trend. I think using a script language to kind of gluing some of this software together. And we call Saviour, semi-automated virus. From that, we were able to get a structured alliance from within basically 2 days from the scratch to the other. So I think in today's standard, if you have a good specimen, you can do it probably a few days. Okay? And so now, alliance, now how I convince you with that alliance, again, I need to look for sausage. I'm hungry. So this is, we accept one of the subunits, then you can actually, again, use the Helix Hunter program. Instead of, now we have a version, it says, represented by cylinder, now we have a ribbon. To look like more structure. So you can see that actually the structure density, the density of this map is extremely well. So I think the take home message is, I think a lot of this mature technology is time that we can actually be put into a kind of routine and user-friendly mode. And so, lastly, I want to touch base in the next few minutes about what I think about the cryo-EM technology development in the future. First of all, about the instrumentations. I believe the instruments today are pretty good, actually very good, no matter either FEI or Joe or Hill or Hitachi. I mean, these are all well-built microscopes. And so people keep asking, you know, which microscope do you buy? It's just like which kind of car you like to buy, either Toyota or Mercedes-Benz. They're both good cars. They're all expensive. And they all can get to where you want to go. So now, but on the other hand, if you think about the future, which you want to push the envelope, and I think there's a few things we can think, we need to think about. Even though all the microscope manufacturers, they say, I can see tongling or Fresnel fringes forever. It's like very coherent. That's true, based on their criteria. But from my point of view, they are not coherent enough, okay? So I want to say, we need a microscope better coherence. Now, in order to expand this, I need another hour to explain what the coherent means. But the bottom line is, at the condition you and I take the pictures, the conditions are not coherent at all. This is not the condition that the manufacturer tests the microscope. Okay, so I think it definitely needs better coherence. If we can improve that by factor 2 or 3, we are much, much better off. That means we have better contrast. That means it will be much easier to get the orientation correctly from the single particles. So I think that's definitely one thing that the manufacturer needs to take note. Now, the other one is we need an optimum specimen temperature, because the other night there are some questions about the temperatures. And again, there's a long controversy, but based on my experience, now, my preference is not 40 degrees Kelvin, not liquid nitrogen, but something in between. Okay? If something in between, I think there's some practical importance. Something that you have probably less charging, better contrast, and don't have nitrogen contamination, but also you get the benefit of the reduction of radiation depth, okay? So I think this is an area, I think, that definitely needs more attention. Of course, energy filter will be a desirable thing. I think people think about only the fixed specimen in energy filter. I don't think that is the only case. I think thin specimen also will benefit on energy filter. Now, you put a 150 angstrom carbon film, you do the right experiment, you see, actually, you will gain some benefit in terms of signal to noise. Of course, you need a large CCD. Nobody wants to work in a dark room. So right now, we can have 2K and 4K, and they are 9K or maybe 12K CCD. That is a very welcome trend. I mean, the sad news is the expense of such a big camera will be as expensive as the microscope. I keep telling the manufacturer, microscope may be coming accessory to the camera company. Of course, we like to follow Bridget's champion to automate everything for the data collection. I think these technologies definitely will be forthcoming with the conceptual guidance from Scripps here. I think the rest of the world definitely will follow, including hopefully the manufacturers. So that's that much about the instrumentations. And so now about the other, I call the computational infrastructures. And I think definitely need better algorithms. And I think, you know, like even in the 2D case on the Heidegger array, I think as I pointed out, Fourier averaging is extremely powerful. Don't misunderstand me. If you have the right specimen, use them because they the quickest way to get answer. But I think for those who want to involve algorithm development, there's definitely an opportunity to do differently. Now, the other is the database. And I think the database has two reasons. One is to keep track all your data, because now, we begin to do biological experiments, we want to change conditions, so we want to be something really easy to get into some electronic notebook. I mean, the database is kind of misleading. I would call it kind of electronic notebooks. And so that electronic notebook should have a capability that you can mine the data. Because many of us only care about the good data or successful data that can go to the published in the magazine. But my interest, I think many of our interests ought to be focused on so-called bad data. Because by understanding why we get the bad data, we'll hopefully we'll get better data. And so I think the kind of database we need to build is not only just archiving and web-based and easy to use, but have the mineable capability. In other words, we can retrieve it and look back. Because I have experienced a couple of times, the data were there 5 years ago, which we thought was a company data. 5 years later, no new data, using a new way of looking at it, we actually improved 5 to 10x from resolution. And I'm fairly sure some of the older guy probably have the experience. So I think as technology goes on, actually some of the old data are probably better than you thought it is. So now the other thing is about visualization. I mean, many of you saw this movie and you saw many other movies in the talk. And I think by last complex, I think a way I would consider particular animations. I think one of the things I want to emphasize, animation is not only to show, to impress your friends, your deans, your chairman, and your peers, but I would consider it's a discovery process. Because once you get these structures so complicated, there's so much information. I think by doing an animation help you to consolidate what you have in your data. And then from then on, from the animation, you say, okay, this frame, stop, figure 1A, stop, figure 5B. Okay, so I think an animation I consider as a tool in addition to any presentation's media. And then the other one I would promote is a unifying type of image process environment. Now, I believe that in the field, everybody writing software, not everybody, a lot of people writing software, I think it's a mistake to think we need to consolidate all the one software. I think it's a wrong idea. I think just like you go to a shopping mall, it's not one restaurant, there are many restaurants. So I think the question is, how are we going into the shopping mall to get what you want? You go to the barber shop to get your hair fixed, and you go to the deli to get a sandwich, or you get a coffee shop. So I think we should have an environment that easily pick up what is good in each of the software. Okay, I believe that each software has its strength and its weakness. There's no doubt about it. And even in the crystallography community, it's not one software to solve all the problems. I think it's a mistake to push one software only. I think you have multiple software, but it's important to push an environment that the biology can easily use those software without going to school to learn. And I think one important thing is to be directly deposited to some public repository site like Protein Database. I think it's a very important, particularly for those of you who are going to solve a lot of structure, like myself. When I solve the publisher structure, the guy gone, I don't have the structure anymore. I really like to have that somewhere that I can get myself, which I'm the co-author. So I think be able to park your structure in a public domain, I think put it in a safe place, I think it's important. And so the other community, the biology can make use of it and so on and so forth. And I think it's also important to use these ConnectDisk structure analysis program. Like Charlie Brooks just walked in, I think his lecture will tell you how he can use the cryo-EM structure to go beyond that. And I think in here, we hope in this image processing environment, be able to have another button, Charlie Brooks, you know, or Watch You or Tim Baker. So there's another paradigm of software. You can play around. We like to play. I mean, so this, I think, would allow you to extract additional information. And finally, I think it's very important, we need to think about specimen preparation. I think this is a lot of things we put under the rug. And I think garbage in, garbage out. I think the freezing step is very critical. I think for those of you who are doing day-to-day experiment, I mean, you sweat. I mean, it's not this fancy software, it's not this fancy microscope, but actually how you get your van particle to stick on the grid in ice. So I think this is currently a fundamental limitation in a lot of this structure at high throughput manner. So I think we like to have a freezing effort that can be automatically done. We don't want graduate students to do it because that's a thing they hate to do, or postdoc, because they think they're wasting their time. So we want the robot to do it. So I think there's some preliminary introduction of this apparatus, but I think far from perfection. I think there's a lot of room for improvement. What type of grid now? We all go into the quantified grid, but is that really the best grid? I'm not sure. I mean, it's convenient for some applications, but it may not be for everything. So I think and particularly dealing with the charging problem and so on and so forth, and how you treat the grid, and what type of few papers that you brought the grid. I mean, these all need the greedy problem. I think it definitely needs somebody has this chemist mind to tackle this problem. And finally, I think I want to raise a question, when does the future end? You know, I talk about the future, when does the future end? I think the future end is we don't need this kind of workshop anymore. I'd love to come to Scripps and to have this workshop. But in reality, the future is when we don't need this workshop. That means every biologist in my class will be. Right, thank you. Oh yeah, no, those floating islands, actually, it has been CTF corrected, and you actually have the B factor has been anisotropically corrected as well. Yes, because this direction is not the same. So, empirically speaking, I need to say exactly, I think it may be a bit of a threshold issue, and one of the problems is as follows. Again, we have not yet completely exhausted the third averaging yet, because now we assume the whole active subunit is a rigid body. So in reality, according to Ed Eggermann and others, it may not be a rigid body, right? So we have four domains, so we don't allow any domain move at all at the moment. So I think our next step on the averaging is to let it move. Okay, so, and I think that is part of the reasons. In the first average, we only see three helices. Okay, because this is the first approximation. Once we take into account that the molecule can orient differently, then we see more helices. Okay, so I think if we allow the domain to move, we may see even more. So I think this map, I think is not the final one that I like to see, but that's what I want to point out, is that lots of post-processing steps you need to take care of in order to see the thing you want to see. But that's a good point. Hi, Elizabeth. Oh, sorry. Please. Yes, that's a good question. So we have the normal mode expert right here. So in fact, we have a paper coming out in Structure using the normal mode analysis as part of the refinement scheme, particularly when the molecule become to be flexible. So definitely, that is what I mean by better algorithm. You know, using what other computational procedures to help you to refine the structure is definitely very, very promising. I think it's a happy marriage between the computational scientists and the cryo-EM people. Oh, no, okay, so you're talking about how you use the normal analysis to improve the image processing step. That's one use. The other is using normal analysis to understand the function and the flexibility. So they're two different processes. So like anything else, when you move, you start hand waving. You see, you can move wherever way you want. So, I mean, that's why you need to have some education, you know, to go to learn from Charlie Brooks and these kind of specialists. But at the same time, you know, whoever does it need to understand the image processing, all the protein properties. And so that's a non-trivial thing. Like everything is approximation. As long as you do it in moderation and with understanding with all the constraints, you'll be okay. But that's going to be very powerful. Yes, Ma? Yes. Okay, so there are two ideas. Depends on what condition and what microscope. So like liquid helium microscope, we need to buy not only a big microscope, we need to buy a baby microscope to bake the grid overnight. That's what we do. And it turned out to be very, very, that's very true. What Nigel said is correct, so that's what we did. But the other was the kind of sandwich with two carbon film. And we actually have a paper coming up in microscopy and microanalysis with Michelle Sherman now with her team, that we coat the carbon on top of the post-nitration, and that definitely reduces the charging. But I think that particular application, I think it's not too useful for single particle, because you, single particle, you don't want to have any additional substrate to smear out the contrast. So I think that's what I was interested about the particular types of grid. Okay, so if the grid is in such a way it's more conducting than carbon, you know, you don't use carbon film anymore. I mean, that's the idea Bob Gates and Ken Downing had. I mean, one can make a different type of grid, so make it more conductive. I think that is probably a viable approach. But so far, I think at kind of four angstrom level, I think that doesn't seem to be a problem for some specimen. And I also experienced that actually the extended charging is also specimen dependent. What kind of buffer you have in there? And that seemed to be kind of critical. So it's a lot of little things. But assuming, so those kind of empirical thing, that's why all these people